Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking home improvement on the program today. We're going to focus a bit on home electrical systems, but we'll take, as usual, all of your home improvement questions. A couple of guests for you. Back with us for many a time. He's been with us, Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Design Build, Monona and Madison. Chad, good to see you.
Thanks, Larry. Always great to be here.
And with us for the first time, Adam Gullickson, the service manager at The Electrician Incorporated in Verona. And Adam, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Adam, let's start with you. Tell us about your background and your business.
Thank you for having me on, Larry. I have been in the trades now for about 12 years. 10 of those have been just electrical with The Electrician Incorporated. So it's essentially the only trade that I've put essentially all of my life into.
Sure.
I started at The Electrician as sort of a helper or a laborer. And then from there, with hard work and things like that, was moved to an apprentice, started school. From there, kind of turned into a service tech once you get your license and things like that. And then I spent some time in the field, and now I'm in the office kind of overseeing jobs and project managing and things like that.
So you've kind of gone through the whole gamut.
I have.
Electricity.
Yep. It's been quite a road, but we're here now.
Chad, what kinds of wiring capabilities are your customers looking for these days?
Yeah, so a lot of folks are looking to improve the technology in their homes. You know, smart homes is a big thing,
yeah.
And sometimes that does include some wiring, though a lot of it is wireless. But it still has to do with the infrastructure within the home. We put in a lot of LED lighting to speak directly to the electrical question. And of course, we work on older homes, so it's not uncommon to still be upgrading those panels, the electrical panels within a home, and the service, the amount of electricity coming in to the house sometimes has to be upgraded. Homes that are, say, 100 years old, I'd say 80 to 100 years old, often started out with a 60-amp service. Nowadays, it's hard to get by with less than 100 amps, and larger homes typically will require 200 amps. And so those are common upgrades.
I've had a friend looking for a house, an older home, and in several cases when she's been in the home to look around, she's found that, there's knob and tube.
Yep, that's a very common issue that we run into, Larry. It's very, still very common in Madison here. There are lots of old homes here. And so it seems like every time we finish a knob and tube project and say, well, this has got to be the last of it in Madison, another one comes along and here we are again.
Yeah, so what, you know, somebody might say, well, what the heck is knob and tube, and what's the new version of, the safe version of that?
Yeah, so knob and tube is essentially, it's two individual conductors wrapped in cloth instead of a PVC coating, which is what we use now. It didn't used to be dangerous when it first came out, but now, you know, people like to have insulation and they like to have their home nice and tight for winter and things like that. People are also putting more fans in their bedrooms and things like that. And that's when that knob and tube becomes dangerous, is because it's cloth covered and you're putting insulation around it and creating more and more heat around it. And so that's why it's a good idea to just get that out of your home entirely.
Makes sense. Dave in Kenosha has a question that may relate to that. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi. Yeah, I was curious. I have a house built in 1952, currently has 100-amp service, but seems like the new standard is 200-amp service, and I'm wondering if that would be value money well spent to upgrade the house to 200-amp service, and about how much can I expect something like that to cost me?
So, electrical service line coming into the house?
Yeah, so it's a very good question. You know, going forward, it's all about how much do you plan to expand your house? You know, if you plan to remodel or get an EV charger or put a hot tub in, things like that, it's always a good idea to upgrade that panel, just because you're going to want that future ampacity to support all the things that you want to install in your house. If you're still running on a 100-amp system, there's not a whole lot that you can add to that, unfortunately. You might be able to You might be able to add maybe one EV charger, but other than that, a remodel, things like that, they're almost out of the question, just to be on the safe side.
So 200 amps is kind of the standard?
It is. 200 amps is about what we're putting in everything. You know, even some duplexes, if we want an EV charger on that duplex, it still gets 200 amps, just because we don't want to risk it.
And in terms of cost, I said that's going to vary depending on what you have to do. I mean, if you have to tear stuff out.
Yep. So, you know, that can vary depending on municipality, you know, if it's overhead service or underground service, things like that. Normally, typically, it goes from around $4,300 to $4,700.
Somewhere in there.
Yep, somewhere around there. And you'll find that's pretty typical. We try to stay competitive in the Madison area with that price.
Dave, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Brad in Jefferson, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Sort of a related question to the previous one about the panel, but this was, I had an electrician out to look at the issue of accommodating an EV. Decided not to go that route at this point. We're buying a hybrid instead, a little bit at a time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, looking at the panel, well, you have a push-button panel. That should be replaced with a switch panel. The push-button panels are no good. And I'm always kind of a little bit hesitant when I hear these sort of blanket statements like that. Is that true, though? Should that factor into my decision about panel replacement, not just the amperage, but because it's a push-button and not a switch?
So what's the difference between a push-button and a switch to begin with, Adam?
So a long time ago when breaker panels first started coming out, I shouldn't say a long time ago, it was probably in 50s, 60s in that area, around where knob and tube was coming in, and then we kind of hit the 70s era when fuse panels were being removed. What they first installed was a push button breaker. It was their idea of an easy way to reset the breaker and not have to put a new fuse in all the time. As time went on, they realized that these push buttons have a tendency to not trip when the wires are overloaded. It doesn't happen to every situation, but it just is something that they noticed. That blanket statement isn't necessarily false, but it is something that should be looked at just to remediate, just because those push buttons, I don't see very many of them around, if at all, anymore, just because people are so adamant on getting them out of their homes.
And so is it a lot of work to change those panels out?
You know, it's a lot of people take advantage of it. So if it's a 100 amp push button and they want the panel replaced, it's not that much more to upgrade to 200 amps. So a lot of people are using it as an excuse to take the jump and go to 200 amps anyway.
All right. Brad, does that help?
It factors into our decision making. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Richard in Columbus will give you a chance. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I was calling about the fallen wire that the house we have has that. Can the homeowner replace the wire and stuff and then have it inspected?
All right. Can a homeowner actually replace the... Is it the knob and tube that we're talking... Yeah, can you...
Yeah, so, and that's where it gets a little difficult. It's a matter of, we get into that permitting issue at that point. A homeowner can technically do whatever they would like on their own home. It's their home. They can do, if they want to replace the wiring and things like that, it's a matter of when it comes down to selling it. When somebody goes to sell a home and they, you know, find out that there aren't permits pulled, but for some reason the knob and tube has been remediated, it can bring up questions, whether it was done correctly, professionally, things like that.
So you can do it, but if you did it yourself, you would then want to have it inspected.
Yeah, essentially, you have to follow the same guidelines that we as electricians have to follow, the NEC, the National Electric Code.
And...
yeah,
well, I wouldn't do it.
Well, and just, I wanted to clarify...
Yeah.
Because there's really two questions being asked here, or issues being raised, because the homeowner definitely can perform these tasks and they can go down and obtain a permit. And I can speak to the Madison area. Inspectors tend to be very encouraging and helpful with a homeowner.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, when they're dealing with those of us that are professionals, they're a little bit less tolerant of our lack of knowledge if mm-hmm. we exhibit lack of knowledge. But a homeowner is going to be nurtured typically by the electrical inspector or any other building inspector when they've pulled that permit. So I would encourage this person to go through the process, if they do want to do it themselves, with the permit and the oversight of the inspector.
Yeah.
What Adam referred to is that, you know, risk of not having the permit. You know, there's no harm, no foul if you've gone mm-hmm. through the permit process and you've done it as a homeowner. But if you haven't obtained the permit, then you raise all sorts of liability issues that, and you really are technically breaking the law by not obtaining the permit before you do that work.
You know, I've looked at a couple of homes. This is years back. I can remember looking at some, couple of homes that where there had been some remodels done, you know, like in the upstairs and so forth, and they weren't permitted. And when I found that out, I just said, you know what, this looks really nice, but I'm not even going to bother because I don't want the headaches. Mm-hmm.
You right. never know what was done beforehand. And it's just, when it comes to electrical, it's sort of a toss-up at that point because the wire is inside the walls. So, yeah. you know, in order to inspect it, you almost have to take the walls off at that point.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, there you go. Thanks for that question. Tim and Ladysmith will give you a chance. Hi, Tim.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a question about service panels. Currently, I have an 8-year-old home with a 125-amp panel that's fed by triplex through the I-beams of my basement. So it's wrapped. It's not fed through conduit to that. I'm looking at expanding and doing some renovation in my basement, and the panel is arc fault. I don't know if I would have to push it up to a 200-amp panel and have a copper line running Schedule 80 PVC run to that to a new panel and do a 200-amp 40 space, or it's more fastidious, if I can, to put a sub-panel on that main panel. But I don't know if the sub-panel can be arc fault breaker. And then the second question I had was, there was renovation done to the home before. There was electrical work done in the basement. They pulled a permit for the electrical, but they also did HVAC and plumbing and never pulled a permit. As I'm a new home buyer, can I have the city inspector come back and inspect what a permit wasn't pulled for? Thanks for taking my call.
All right. Chad, well, what on that point, Chad, what do you think?
Well, I would say there's no harm in calling up the inspection desk and having a conversation about this to see what they might be willing to do or able to do. But as Adam noted before, you know, one of the problems with a lot of the mechanical systems being inspected after the fact is we just don't.
They're in the walls.
There's a lot of things you can't test for, but there are some important things that can be tested. And another route to go is to hire a home inspector that would come in and essentially assess the electrical system that you have to make sure that all of the outlets are properly grounded and that the switches seem to be operating properly and things like that. They can open up the service panel and inspect the work. So then really the issues that you can't know are things like
Tim was asking about plumbing.
Right. And also, like, you know, for example, there's a reason why when you drill through the studs or the framing in a home, you know, the wires have to be at least an inch back from where the drywall is being attached, because then when you're attaching something to the wall, you're reducing the chances of that wire being compromised by a screw or a nail or something. And, of course, plates have to be installed whenever the wiring is within an inch of that space. And so it's things like that that are hard to figure out, and then you learn them the hard way when a, you know, something is attached to the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Adam?
Well, you know, I would say for this caller, he's not out anything if he does call a home inspector or somebody like that to come and take a look at the other, you know, the plumbing and the HVAC that were done without a permit. Obviously, the electrical was looked at, so you got to presume that the inspector looked at the electrical and everything is good. He's not out anything if that home inspector comes and finds something, and I would recommend still maybe having a home inspector come and just kind of picking their brain and seeing what they find. Yeah. As far as that 125-amp panel goes in the basement, If you're finishing your basement and you're trying to, you know, make a bedroom or offices or bathrooms or things like that, I would recommend upgrading that 125 or 150 to a 200 amp. And, you know, you do have the triplex coming through your I-beams in your basement. What we would end up doing in that case is we set what's called a meter main on the outside of the house, because we are only allowed 8 feet from that meter socket, 8 feet of raceway on the outside of a house from that meter socket to our panel. So if he wants to have the panel in the exact same place and those wires are coming through the basement, we would set a meter main on the outside and then refeed that panel in the same exact area. So it is possible with those URD wires and the triplex coming from the basement.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for that question, Tim. Appreciate it very much. Talking with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build of Monona and Madison, Adam Gullickson, service manager at The Electrician Incorporated in Verona. It's great to have both of them with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at home remodeling and repair today with our two guests, we've zeroed in a bit on electrical. Listener called in, couldn't stay with us. They have a digital watt meter that they need replaced, and they're wondering about the best options for replacement and if this is something that can be done himself or it needs to be done by a professional. And you might start by talking about what is a digital watt meter.
Yes, they might be using some slang that, you know, the electrical jargon that they think might be right. The electrical watt meter, I'm not quite sure what they're referring to. Mm-hmm. I can only assume that they're referring to their meter on the exterior of their house.
Okay.
Yep. If they are, or it's some sort of metering equipment that goes in your panel that tracks how much amperage you use on circuits and things like that. Any sort of metering equipment at all in general should be handled by a licensed electrician, just because that main panel that's coming into your house, you can't shut off. That's live power coming from your meter socket, and so it can get very dangerous very quickly. And so anytime you want metering equipment or you want to open up that main panel, I would just call your friendly neighborhood electrician and just see what they have going on.
Wondering, are you getting a lot of questions from folks who have all electric vehicles and want to get some installation done on that?
Yes, that's very big right now. Everybody seems to be purchasing electric vehicles, EVs. I noticed the biggest thing is they purchase the vehicle so that, you know, they go to the dealership, they're looking for a new vehicle, and there happens to be an EV sitting there. And, you know, everything looks good, and they get talked into purchasing it. No big deal in any way, shape, or form. But then when they come home and it comes time to charge it, they find that the 120-volt charger they have that comes with the vehicle standard isn't going to be enough for replacing a daily use vehicle. And so that's where we come in, as we install those level 2 chargers that are able to charge your vehicle overnight while you're sleeping at your home.
So what's so they're typically, obviously, then they're by the garage. Mm-hmm. It's an exterior garage away from the house.
Yep, in some of those cases, we end up having to trench power to that detached garage, set a panel, because we have to be able to distribute that power somehow, and then we have your EV charger in that detached garage. It's just a matter of where you want that charger. If you want it in a detached garage, you're going to have to trench. Otherwise, in Madison, I know everybody has kind of shared driveways that run along the outside of their house. What we've actually been getting away with is putting those EV chargers on the side of the house, so that way they can still park in their driveway, but they can still charge.
Okay. And if you already have electricity running to the garage anyway?
And that's where it gets tricky as well, because some people just have one 120-volt circuit running out to that detached garage. Unfortunately, those level 2 chargers are 240-volt, and so we would have to run a brand new line out to that detached garage.
Okay. Well, that's it. We had a different kind of question here from Mark in Appleton. Some electrical may come into this, but Mark, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, guys. So we've got a house built in the early 1960s. All of the bathrooms have the original toilets. They're like a wall mount, 3.5-gallon flush. You can tell they're original just because of the colors. It's like banana yellow, seafoam green. We're looking at remodeling our bathrooms, but I guess what I'm wondering is, do they make a like modern day home version of a wall mounted toilet, or am I going to have to get all of those replumbed to the floor and have a more standard floor mounting toilet?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mark. So there are modern wall-mounted toilets, and I had one installed in my own home about 8-10 years ago. And we've done them for some clients. They're not that common. I would say they, you know, probably constitute less than 5% of the toilets that go in, maybe closer to 1%, but they are available. One of the issues is that the tank is actually in the wall that holds the water. And so, you know, the wall is probably going to be opened up, and the mechanism for hanging that toilet on the wall is pretty critical that be solid. So it's a little more involved, typically, because you have to get into the wall, and then when you put the wall back together, it has to be structurally sound to then carry the weight of that wall-mounted toilet that people are going to be sitting on. So, you know, there are just a lot of details, but I would encourage you to seek out a plumber in the Appleton area that has some experience with wall-mounted toilets, and you should have a few options to choose from.
Would it be, just as a follow-up to that, would it be cheaper for Mark to put in a sort of a, what we would call, might call a standard toilet versus?
Yeah, well, so there again, I mean, it all will come down to the details, because right now that 4-inch pipe is running through the wall.
Yeah.
And it might be more challenging and costly to switch everything and gain access to the space below that where that toilet wants to mount on the floor
if you
were to change it. So really, you know, devil will be in the details. But if you lived in a one-story home, or if you just were remodeling a bathroom that was over an unfinished space or a space that you could easily access the ceiling below where the toilet wants to be, you might consider switching to a traditional floor-mounted toilet. But wall-mounted toilets have a lot of appeal.
Yeah.
And if you've already got one, it might be nice to find a way to replace it.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. What in bathrooms, Adam, typically, are there electrical issues that come up with a remodel of a bathroom? Chad can probably talk to this, too.
Yeah, I would. I'm sure Chad can attest to this as well. Most of the time, when a bathroom is remodeled in an older home, there's not a dedicated circuit for the outlet. So that's the number one thing that we run into for bathroom remodels. Because we've touched that space, we're required to bring it up to code. Chad will attest to that as well. Once you touch a space and start remodeling, you have to bring it up to code. And so as a result, we have to get a dedicated line from the bathroom outlet down to the panel, wherever it may be. So in some cases, when people are remodeling a second story bathroom, getting a line down to the basement to their panel can be fairly tricky. Mm-hmm. And it can kind of be an unexpected cost that they have to take on now for a bathroom remodel.
Okay. That's something really important to consider along the way here.
Yep.
Mark in Appleton, your turn.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I was going to ask the same thing as more expensive.
Yeah.
The fact that it's going to all be about whether or not it's cheaper to move that pipe versus the cost of the more expensive toilet might wash itself out. So I've got a plumber I work with, but I appreciate all the feedback and realizing that I'll need to upgrade the electrical when I do it as well. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, all right. Mark, thanks a lot.
Good luck.
I'll be up in the Appleton area on Saturday, as a matter of fact, Mark. So there you go. Dean in Marquesan, your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for your show.
Sure.
I have, we remodeled our home in 2019 and added quite a bit of living space. We had the electrical upgraded, new panel, and the electrician also ran a line into the garage so that we could hook up a generator if we lost power. and I have a generator. The missing part is the cabling from the generator to the outlet in the garage. And is that something that I could do myself, or would you suggest I get an electrician to make that cable?
So that's a very good question. When it comes to generators, I would always, always recommend hiring a professional. The reason being is because it can get very tricky because generators are an independent source of power that feeds your panel. And so if you don't have the correct safety measures, essentially you need to install what's called an interlock. And what that interlock does is when the generator is feeding that panel, it prevents the main breaker of your panel from being on at the same time. Because at that point, if your main breaker is on, you're going to feed power back to a utility lineman. And that's how you actually end up killing linemen, unfortunately. It can get very dangerous. When it comes to generators like that, the situation you have for a portable generator inlet is what it's called instead of an outlet is not very expensive to finish, especially if you have the line run already. So at that point, I would just suggest hiring a professional. It shouldn't take too much. It should be about a day's worth of work, and they can get you fired up and all set with your generator.
All right. What are the options for generators? That's one option. Are there other options?
Yeah, so there are portable generators that this customer just happened. It sounds like he has a portable generator that when the power goes out, he's going to roll up, plug it in, and then he's going to hit that interlock that the electrician installs just to keep the lineman safe. And then he'll be able to run his house on portable generator power. Some people, once they hit a certain age, they don't want to be lugging that generator, that big heavy generator out in a thunderstorm every time the power goes out. So what we end up installing for them is what's called an ATS. It's called an automatic transfer switch. And so this works with a standalone generator. So when the power goes out, this automatic transfer switch can tell the panel is not getting power anymore, and it will tell the generator to kick on automatically. So within about 10 seconds, you don't have to worry about lugging the generator out. You don't have to worry about it being out of gas. It'll just, the generator, the standalone one, will turn on, and you'll have power again.
Yeah, that sounds like the way to go. And I suppose that's what we see in like hospitals, for example, where they've got to have power right away.
Yep. In that case, it actually has to almost be uninterrupted power. So the changeover almost needs to be immediate for those critical standby systems for hospitals and things like that. So the 10-second gap you have on a residential, that won't fly in a hospital.
Oh, okay. Rich in Madison, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hello. My wife got an estimate for having a portion of our driveway replaced because the settling has been so drastic that it's like a step into the garage. And the first estimate was about $20,000, and then she asked me to attend, and the second and third estimate were dramatically less. And the one we liked is a product called EcoCrete. They said it takes a month to cure. Can you tell us anything about that?
EcoCrete, you ever use that, Chad?
Well, so I'm familiar with a few different concrete products, and I would also speak to the question of cost. And another option I want to mention as well, but there is concrete out there which is porous concrete, and this is a type of concrete that essentially will allow water to flow through it. Some people might refer to that as eco-concrete, but because it's good for reducing runoff.
Okay.
But that sort of a concrete is requires much more thorough and proper preparation and a deeper base for it to work properly. I believe there's a company in the Madison area which is actually called EcoConcrete, and they essentially buy carbon offsets, if I understand their business model correctly, to put in a traditional concrete product. So that's purely an offset kind of equation there.
And, okay.
And so that might be what Rich is referring to. I'm not sure. I wanted to additionally just mention that obviously, depending on what you're getting and how well it's installed, prices will vary drastically with any almost any home improvement that you might consider. So knowing exactly what the different, it sounds like you've gotten three proposals for this, what they've proposed, you know, that's going to determine what its value is and whether or not you're getting good value for the product that would be installed. I don't know what the condition of your slab is right now, but if it is simply settled, one thing that you might consider doing, which is significantly more expensive, and I would argue potentially ecologically better, is to just have the concrete raised or lifted. Hmm. And there are a variety of companies that can inject either foam or other materials under that existing slab and raise it up to where it's supposed to be. It's not uncommon to have settling sometimes when this sort of work is done, and that is a rather cost-effective solution. Again, if the slab is in good shape, except that it has settled, I would encourage you to look into having it raised.
Wow. Yeah, makes good sense, and maybe and save some money in the process.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rich, thanks a lot for calling. Dennis in Afton, Minnesota. We'll go to you now. Hi,
yeah,
Dennis.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hi. Yep. Hi. Yep. Thanks, Larry, Wisconsin Public Radio, and guests. Appreciate it. Your producer says this is a good question, and it's relevant to being an owner of a small cabin. They're thinking about starting up the electricity again, which they haven't done for a while, and have me come in and do some carpentry repairs. But I'm not into, without checking it out, what's the wiring status? They said there was some positive squirrels and chipmunks in there. But if there's a bare wire somewhere in the walls, is that a danger? I mean, you start it up again, it could be sparking.
Yes, so anytime that you have wires that have been compromised by critters, things like that, there's a fairly good chance that it... In a normal electrical system, your breaker should trip when those bare wires make contact. It's all dependent on the type of panel you have. You know, earlier we discussed if you had those old panels that don't like to trip, those push buttons, when you turn power back on, if you have those old push buttons, there's a potential there that that breaker won't trip and those wires will continue to arc until they create a fire. So I guess if you're going back to the cabin and you're worried about the power there, I would turn your main breaker on first and then slowly turn your single breakers on each individually one by one, just to make sure that if one has an issue, you're going to know exactly which one it is. And it's going to, that breaker, if it is working correctly and it is within, 30, 40 years old, it will do its job and it will trip if those two wires touch or come in contact with each other. Now, that being said, I don't want you to go in and just turn your breakers on and maybe think everything's hunky-dory. I would, if you can, I would try to put your eyes on those wires that you think are compromised and just make sure that they are in good condition.
Yeah. Dennis, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Nina in Menasha, your turn. Hi, Nina.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am... pretty much a forever renter. I've lived in my apartment for 22 years, and I could never own a home. It's just out of my reach. Anyway, and I am very curious because we were out of power several times. One time we were out for 5 days, and I lost everything in my freezer, and I had to go stay somewhere. But is there any suggestion that you have for a type of generator that, well, we can't have the gas because, you know, the other neighbors. And but do you have any suggestions for apartment friendly generators?
All right. Generators for apartment dwellers.
Yes. So the unfortunate part is, excuse me, without that being able to use gas and have that combustion, essentially with propane, you know, natural gas, diesel, regular unleaded, things like that, it's very hard to have backup systems that will last a long time, that will keep you, that will just last for hours on end. For apartment dwellers, the only option you really have is a backup battery system, like a UPS. The unfortunate part is you're not going to get for a freezer and things like that. It's not going to last you too terribly long. You might be able to get 5 hours out of it if you get a very large one. But without that constant flow of fuel and combustion, you're not going to be able to do it, unfortunately. The UPS is the best option that you would have as an apartment dweller. A lot of people use it for their computers and things like that. They have variable sizes. So if you want a 1 hour one, you can purchase that. If you're willing to spend, you know, more money on it, you can get a 5 to 6 hour one if you want. It's just going to be very, very large in the end.
Yeah. So, what about the owner of an apartment building?
The owner of an apartment building could have that whole apartment building put on a standby generator if he wanted to. Granted, that's, you know, his cost and everything like that. So it's a matter of talking your landlord into if, you know, he could even have a portable generator if you wanted, just to have a couple of people being able to keep the refrigerators on and things like that.
Okay. Nina, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're visiting today with Adam Gullickson, service manager at the Electrician Incorporated in Verona. Also with Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build in Monona and Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at home remodeling and repair today, we've zeroed in a bit on electrical, but we've taken other questions as well with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build of Monona and Madison, and Adam Gullickson, service manager at the Electrician Incorporated in Verona. Joe emailed us, we got an electrical question here. Joe says, initial breaker service panels routed the neutral wire and the ground wire to the same neutral ground attachment within the breaker panel. Now almost all service panels have a dedicated and separate ground lugs within the panel. What is the advantage of having the dedicated ground separated from the neutral lug?
So I think I understand what he's talking about here. So in your main panel, it's what is called the first point of disconnect. The first point of disconnect on any residential home, your grounds and neutrals do have to be together. So, and not together under the same lug, they just have to be at the same potential, essentially. From there, say you add a sub-panel further down in your house or, you know, on the second floor or something like that. That, in that panel, is where you have to have the grounds and neutrals separated. And that's been a code for quite some time now. They just want that separate path from the main panel to the sub panel. So if it's in your main panel that you're looking at and your grounds and neutrals are together, that's perfectly fine. They're supposed to be together just because they want everything to come back to that one main point on the exterior of your house or interior in this case, for the main panel. So everything revolves around that first point of disconnect. Obviously, that sub panel is going to be a second point of disconnect. Your grounds and neutrals are going to be separated, and that's where you're going to run into those panels that have that extra bar.
Got it. Scott emailed us. Scott recently installed a heat pump. It's a variable speed unit, and when cooling the house, the compressor on the heat pump will drop to 45%, according to the thermostat, and it will emit a radio frequency which causes a humming or cricket sound in the cooking stove. It will cause a newer LED light fixture to flicker as well. The contractor put a filter on the power line to the heat pump, but that didn't change anything. Any ideas? Would a four wire to the stove help?
So there's a lot going on in this call, unfortunately. The first thing I would make sure of is make sure that heat pump is operating correctly. When it comes to individual pieces of equipment, I always revert to the professionals. So if it's a heat pump that got installed, I would assume the HVAC technician and or the plumber who works the valves and things for the heat pump as well, they would be your best bet to make sure that that heat pump is working correctly. After you verify that that heat pump is functioning properly, I would take a look at the brand of LEDs that you have in your house. Sometimes I don't like to name certain brands, especially right now. If you pick the more cost-effective brands, they actually, the heat pump can create what's called noise or chatter. Some certain brands don't like to protect against this chatter, and so that's why, and this extra noise that's created. A four-wire circuit to your stove would absolutely help, just because right now you're probably working on a two-wire system, and so you don't technically have that ground path right now, and a ground path alleviates a lot of this extra noise that's going to get created.
So an LED light, do they the ones that work properly, mm-hmm. do they advertise that fact on the bulb? What are some companies that...
If you were
going to put one in, what LED light would you go to?
Yes, at that point, I always trust Sylvania and Lithonia. They make a very, very solid light bulb. They make a very solid fixture as well. Those two, you're never, ever going to go wrong with. You're going to notice that the price is a little more, but you can almost put that bulb in anywhere and have it acceptable.
Man, what were they again?
Sylvania and Lithonia. Lithonia makes a really good LED fixtures. They make all sorts of brands. And Sylvania is a very good bulb manufacturer that we like to stick with.
Okay. Jody in Brooklyn, your turn. Hi, Jody.
Hi, I appreciate you taking my call. I am wondering about grab bars. I'm calling on behalf of my elderly mom who would like to have one put in her tub surround, mm-hmm. and she would like to put in one that has a suction cup, and I'm concerned that that is not safe, and so I'd like your opinion on that.
And she lives in a mobile home?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So, great question. Thank you, Jody, for calling. Typically, when we're installing grab bars, we are making a connection to something structural in the wall. And if we can't do that, there are fasteners that can be installed still, which grab very well to the materials, toggle bolts and things like this, which we might be able to successfully install if we don't have access to the other side of the wall. With the tub surround, it's always tricky because sometimes these are fiberglass extruded units. There's dead space in there between the wall and the actual unit. And so other things are required. Now, a suction cup, it is very risky to use that because we all know obviously you can have a more expensive device which would be potentially more effective, but my experience with suction cup accessories in the shower, like a mirror, which I have, it just falls off sometimes, and I would not trust a suction cup bar because of the potential for injury. So I would say I would recommend you try to find a qualified handy person that can install something that's going to be permanent and will be attached properly to the wall.
Yeah. Two different things that could go wrong there. The suction fails or the suction doesn't fail, but when she pulls on it, the material that's it's attached to could break or loosen.
Right. Great point. Correct. Correct.
Yeah. So two different ways that could be a problem, Jody. There you go. Scott in Windsor, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have a 25-year-old house with a two-car garage. The garage floor is poured concrete, and the driveway that abuts it is asphalt. And the asphalt has settled quite a bit, creating about a 3 or 4 inch gap. And the concrete beneath where the garage door shuts has essentially turned to dust, leaving a big gap that lets cold air in during the winter.
Mice
ideally,
too.
Yeah. Ideally, of course, you would saw out the rotten pieces until you hit terra firma and re-pour. Is there a cheaper way out of this?
Yeah, so, well, there are two separate things going on here. I mean, there's the deterioration of the concrete, which it can be difficult to successfully repair that long term, depending on what's going on. And it's hard for me to know, not seeing it, exactly what is happening there. But that is something that might need to be cut out and replaced for a proper repair. The asphalt also, I to a previous caller had suggested that with concrete, with a slab, sometimes you can salvage it by having it raised or lifted. But with the asphalt, you really don't have an option like that. The good news is that asphalt is less expensive and less difficult to repair. The portion that is problematic can be cut out. They might be able to just cut it out maybe 4 feet back from the threshold of the garage door, and then repair and restore the base, and then pour a new asphalt drive in that strip that's about 4 feet out. And that way, you know, it won't matter that the driveway has settled further out. There will be a bit of a ramp there that will properly connect all of the surfaces for you to safely come and go. There are also some things that you might consider attaching either to the floor of the garage or to the door to improve that connection between the concrete floor and your overhead door. There's a kind of a,
extenders, are they? Or?
Well, so one thing is just the normal kind of flashing or that kind of rubber piece on the underside of the garage might be able to be replaced. And then there are companies, it's a retrofit, but there you ask for a less expensive option. There are some, they're typically like a hard rubber threshold that you glue down to the floor and the door contacts it when it closes. And that might be a way to improve the situation where concrete meets the door.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. There you go, Scott. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Chad Spade, our guest, owner of Chad's Design Build in Monona and Madison, and Adam Gullickson, service manager at the Electrician Incorporated in Verona, to answer your questions, and they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. I know Billy in Columbus has a question, and Pat in Middleton. We've got an email from Joe to take care of. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the on Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will be back with our guests. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It's a home remodeling and repair day on the show. Had somebody who called earlier and couldn't stay with us, and I want to get back to that person because they called a long time ago. With the flooding going on these days, what tips do either of you have for basic protection? Adam, let me turn to you first on the electrical side.
So when it comes to flooding, you know, there's a couple of things that I would recommend. Obviously, we've been talking about generators today. That's a pretty crucial one because power, when it comes to substantial flooding, power is more than likely going to go out. So if you have that standalone generator and it's up high and doesn't break the gas connection or anything like that, or a portable in this case would probably be more suited because you can put it almost anywhere. Keeping power on in your house to keep those sump pumps rolling is critical. That's going to keep water out of everything. It's going to keep water out of the basement, things like that. The other maybe piece of equipment that I would recommend is a surge protector. You don't want to think that water is going to hit your panel, but there is the off chance that it could. And if that were to happen, water is conductive. So making that connection, there is a chance that it could knock out, you know, your range, your oven, things like that. There was a surge in Madison that happened last year. I think it took out quite a few, maybe about 26, maybe 30 ranges in downtown Madison. It can happen. And so I would recommend, you know, a generator for constant power and probably a surge protector just to protect the equipment in your house.
And the surge protector, is that difficult to...
No, you know, it'll take one of our techs, you know, they can probably install it in about maybe 15, 20 minutes. Wow. The most expensive part is going to be the actual equipment itself because it's designed to take that surge and not let it spread to other parts of your house to take out other pieces of equipment.
Makes good sense. Chad, on your end of things?
Yeah, so one thing for resiliency would be just to start out in the yard and try to divert water, if possible, from the home, from the foundation. So often with flooding, that the groundwater is moving on your property. And so if you have the benefit of some sort of pitch and a low side to the lot, you're trying to divert the water around. I'm not sure there are other things I can recommend. I mean, maintenance, certainly, keeping downspouts and gutters clean and clear.
Making sure those are extended out away from the home.
Correct. Always trying to keep water away from the foundation, moving it away, and being respectful of your neighbors. I mean, when we're in the city here, we're more dense. You're trying to move that water away, but not necessarily just over right into your neighbor's home. And then Adam mentioned it, but I would just add, you know, when you do have a sump system, obviously you do need battery backup often in a storm. And Adam mentioned that, you want to make sure that battery is not going to get flooded because it's not going to work.
All good points. Let's turn to Billy in Columbus next. Hi, Billy.
Larry?
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Hi. First of all, I love your show. I learn something every day I listen to it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the second thing is I have an old farmhouse, and when I bought it 15 years ago, it had a fuse box, and I had that converted to a breaker box, but it's still an old farmhouse. So if you run the microwave, for example, and the TV's on, and you try to run the vacuum cleaner, it'll trip the fuse or the breaker. So I'm wondering how extensive would it be to sort that all out, and is that something that can be done?
Yeah. Great question. This is actually a very common issue that people run into in older homes. So a long time ago, when people would wire homes, you know, they would maybe throw probably almost up to about a half a house on a circuit just because they only had that 60 amp panel when it was built. And so in that 60 amp panel, you probably only have about maybe 8 or 10 fuses. So this, a lot of people run into this issue. What I would recommend is you need to split the circuit up somehow. The easiest way is, say you always trip the circuit when you're vacuuming or something like that. What I would recommend, or when you turn on the microwave in your case, I think is what you mentioned. What I would recommend is pulling a dedicated circuit to that microwave or to where you, that outlet that you always plug the vacuum into, things like that. Just because that seems to be that high amperage draw from a microwave and a vacuum, that's exactly what's going to trip your breaker. Mm-hmm. And so what we would end up doing is pull a dedicated circuit to your preferred spot as a customer. Now, as far as cost goes, there are lots of variables that kind of play into cost. You know, if it's an old farmhouse, I'm assuming that the basement would be unfinished in the ceiling aspect, and hopefully the panel is in the basement as well. If that is the case, it's not too difficult to run a wire just because we have open access to the lower portion of your house. We can run a circuit as far down as we want to and then just come up a shared wall. You know, normally it would probably take a tech, if it's all unfinished, probably about 2-3 hours. As far as cost goes, you'd have to contact, you know, your local electrician and get their hourly rates, though.
Yeah. Billy, there you go. Does that help?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Appreciate the call. Let's turn to Pat in Middleton. Hi, Pat.
Hi. So this question is probably more for Chad. It's got to do with drainage. We had an addition put on. And there's about a 90-square-foot area of roof that we don't have a gutter on yet, but we're getting one. And then our soils there are pretty tight clay. I don't want the gutter to be extremely long just because it'll create a trip hazard. We have a small yard. So I wanted to have it constructed in a certain way that I could dump it into about 3 feet from the foundation of a crawl space, and then it has maybe about a 10 or 12 foot run to where I can let the water drain. And I was thinking about just creating a like a trench, like a French drain, but it doesn't have to be huge. Mm-hmm. And wondered if you could recommend how to construct such a thing. I was looking online at, you know, bigger ones where you have to have like a perforated pipe and all of that, and I wondered if you think I could do that just with a certain size gravel or not.
Sure. So, Pat, thanks for the call. That's a great question. So is there a little bit of a grade differential in this area where you'd like to divert the water? I mean, will it flow away from the house and the foundation?
Yes, it will. And okay, it's probably about like a 1-2% maybe.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, generally, we're wanting to get a 2% grade if we can. And so if it's possible to build up the grade a little without compromising or having contact between, you know, the wood part of your structure and the ground, we would recommend, as part of making this improvement, to either build it up, or the other option is you create a little bit of a swale as you're moving away from the home and, you know, create that low spot, ideally at least 10 feet out from the house. And our goal is always to move the water 10 feet away from the foundation if we can. The simplest thing you might consider doing is digging that trench, or just a slight depression, maybe going down 4 inches, and putting a wash stone or something like that in it that will allow the water to filter through, but also maintain a flat surface for you to be able to walk and things like that, not sure, be the trip hazard that you were hoping to avoid. That would be the simplest way to do it. It sounds like you have the clay soil, so they're naturally going to resist allowing that water to percolate down. So I would approach it that way. Mm-hmm. Is that helpful?
That help, Pat?
Very doable. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Rita in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I have some suggestions for the person that needed a grab bar put up in the shower. First of all, a good resource in your county is the Aging and Disability Resource Center. They should be able to help and give advice and direct them to somebody who could install something. And the other way to install a grab bar might be through the floor, not inside the tub or the shower, but actually on the floor so the person can grab on it in and out of the shower or tub.
Rita, thanks a lot for calling.
Great tips. Thank you, Rita.
Those are great tips. Appreciate that very much, Rita. Let's go to Janine in Fond du Lac. She's looking at having the electrical system redone in her 1955 MCM ranch home. She's working with the program More Like Home. It's the name of the program, More Like Home. She wonders how big of a project is something like this and how much will the house be turned upside down. The present electrical system has fuses in the attic that are no longer available. Many of the switches throughout the house don't even work.
So this is a tougher situation. You know, it sounds like she's wanting almost a whole home electrical remediation just to get the old wiring out of her home. She had mentioned that it is an MCM home. I believe that's a manufactured home, if I'm not incorrect. I could be wrong on that, though. In this case, I would assume it's probably a finished first floor and maybe a finished second floor if there is a dug-in basement. You know, if you're looking to remediate all the wiring in there, there are lots of variables. Just a very broad general time, I would say you're probably looking at about 2-3 electricians, probably a lead and a helper, for probably about a week and a half. And if it is a single story with a finished basement, things like that, they will have to make a few holes in the drywall. It's the only way to get wires from point A to point B, unfortunately. The company I work for, we do specialize in obviously knob and tube remediation and things like that. So we're very good at what's called fishing wires. And so we can fish wires through essentially a stud space, using a very small 7/8 drill bit hole. We've rewired 3-story houses using this method. And it's just, it's all about how much drywall that homeowner wants to take off to remediate. Obviously, if there's more drywall removed, it's going to be a more cost-effective wiring remediation. But if they want less drywall moved, it's going to cost more.
Brian from Washburn emailed, what advice can you give regarding portable solar generators?
So with portable solar generators, I haven't experienced them a whole lot just because they hardly ever tie in with the actual home system, just because the solar and the generator put together in the same aspect is normally it's a set alone equipment system. I can tell you, if you are looking to tie it into maybe an off-grid cabin or your home system, you're more than likely going to require an automatic transfer switch or some sort of interlock or transfer switch that we had talked about earlier. Whenever it comes to generators or solar, you got to have a disconnect or an interlock to make sure that power doesn't feed back to the utility.
Michael emailed us. He just had his water heater replaced after 8 years. There's some controversy whether or not to regularly drain and rinse the water heater to improve its lifespan. How does your guest feel about this?
Yeah, so the issue here is that particularly in southern Wisconsin, I can't speak to other parts of the state, we have very hard water, and the minerals build up in the bottom, and so it's good to flush that system out just to get those deposits out of the tank, because they do corrode the metal in the tank. So it is generally, if you have hard water, you probably know that you have hard water. There are two things to do. Soften that water going into the hot water system so that the water itself in the tank is not as hard and doesn't have all that mineral deposit in it. And then occasionally to flush the water out.
Brian in Minocqua, will go to you now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I just have a question here, or more of a statement, I guess. Do you have an opinion on whether it's important to leave a rain gap between LP smart siding and the structure of the house, using furring strips to fur out the siding. Is it more energy efficient? Is it worth the extra money?
It's definitely best practice for installation of siding, and frankly, any exterior cladding on a home, be it siding, stucco, brick, any of it, is going to perform best long term if it is furred off of the wall, and you have a rain plane that is behind. Is on the wall, and then you have furring, and then you apply whatever you're applying. And so it is going to allow the building to dry out when it gets wet. And then if whatever is put on the building to keep the water out that gets past the siding, that has to be a material that will allow vapor to expel from the building but keep water from going into the building. And so old-fashioned tar paper basically does that, and higher-tech modern materials like a Tyvek will also do that. But it is definitely good for the siding to have that space for the air to move and for the material to dry out.
There you go, Brian. Thank you for calling. Paul emailed, wants your opinion on a smart plug that monitors your home's electrical system to warn about fire hazards. He says his insurance company is recommending a smart plug.
So on this one, I'm not quite sure if he is using this smart plug to control a piece of equipment or something like that. If he's just looking for a smart plug that he can control from his phone using an app, Lutron Caseta makes a very user-friendly plugin you essentially take whatever you're plugging in, you unplug it from the wall, you put in this Lutron Caseta smart plug, and you plug that into the wall, and then you take whatever lamp, whatever have you, and you plug that into the smart plug itself. From there, you're able to connect to your phone using a hub, so you can essentially turn things on and off from your phone using that smart plug.
That makes sense as well. The listener, Diane emailed us. She lives in the country, has a well and septic and a tankless water heater. She doesn't get hot water to kitchen or bathroom sinks unless the tub faucet is run until hot. Ooh. That's not good. She gets hot water from the kitchen or bathroom sinks for a little while, and the tub shower runs hot, then cold, then hot. It doesn't sound like she's got a, I don't know, that tankless water heater.
Well, I wouldn't blame it on the tankless water heater per se, but it sounds like the way the piping was originally installed, or the way it is now, maybe it was altered at some point, has impacted the flow. And there are ways that a plumber can potentially install a recirculating system to help prevent you from having that hot water. When water is in a pipe for a long time, it cools down.
Sure.
And so when you put in a recirculation designed piped system, it allows that when the water gets cold for it to flow back down to the hot water tank and then for the hot water to be replenished. It's a little more complicated when you have a tankless system, but often there is a small tank installed that's a part of that. And that would help reduce the wait time for hot water. And it sounds like something else is going on if she really never gets hot water without certain other things happening. That just sounds like a bad design and perhaps a more holistic approach. Some repiping could fix it and improve it.
Listener, and we talked about this, but a question about a sump pump with in his newer home that does run with a lot of rain. Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions for a backup system should the power go out?
So for a backup system for a sump pump, what I would recommend is whoever you purchase the sump pump through, I believe Helen Brand does sump pumps. There are other, companies around Madison that does that. What I would actually do is go back to them and ask them, because they've installed them, they've seen them, they know what's going to work best with their sump pump that they installed. I would actually ask them and say, yeah, hey, do you have a battery recommendation for the sump pump that you installed at my house? It's 9 times out of 10 fairly easy to install. They're very user friendly, but it is something that I would actually go back to the installer themselves and ask what's going to work best.
And on that note, we are out of time. Adam, Chad, it's been great. Thank you so much. I hope we can do this again. Appreciate
Absolutely.
It very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Larry. Great callers today.
Absolutely.
Great calls. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build, and Adam Gullickson, service manager at The Electrician Incorporated in Verona, our guests. And we'll certainly be talking home improvement again on the program. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about this really special cookbook today called Belly Full, Exploring Caribbean Cuisine Through 11 Fundamental Ingredients and Over 100 Recipes. The author is Leslie Enston. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jill. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Well, we really appreciate you spending some time with us today. And I got to say that your book is really fun. So not only is it fun to look at the recipes, but there's so much really cool information. Why did you decide to write Belly Full?
Well, I'm someone who's been cooking all my life and cooking with my mother all of our lives together. And, I have this great love for Caribbean cuisine in general. I've grown up around all these different islands, and I really noticed that there was a lack of representation on the bookshelf. And I felt like I'm the one who's going to help get us on the map there.
Well, that's a great idea. I mean, a lot of people travel there and have wonderful meals, but then you come back and you're thinking, gosh, I'd like to recreate that. This book will definitely help that. You were talking about your mom and your grandmother, was it, that was helping you in the kitchen when you were growing up?
Just me and my mom.
Oh, okay. And what about your daughter now? You have a little girl. Is she interested in cooking?
She loves it. Yes, she's turning 6 today. She turned 6. She's 6.
Oh, well, happy birthday. What's her name?
Dessaline.
What a wonderful name. Happy birthday, sweetie. Now, you write that the Caribbean is home to so many different peoples and cultures and cuisines, and it's really a melting pot. Talk a little bit about it's a complex history of the Caribbean and maybe how that relates to food.
So, yeah, I always say that Caribbean cuisine, is the first fusion food. Because you had these indigenous people that were already there, and then different Europeans came and were interacting with them. And then they brought over the enslaved Africans who brought their own foodways. And then you had, along the line, you got Indian indentured servants and Chinese indentured servants. And all of this has come together to sort of, it's all blended and mished and mashed and created something totally new.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that it's kind of like there's something for everyone. Everybody can see a little reflection of their own foods in Caribbean food.
Now, as a vegetarian and kind of vegan, I notice that a lot of your recipes don't have, like the dairy in, or they don't have meat. Why is that?
Well, it's sort of twofold. I think that in the Caribbean in general, there is, depending on where you are, of course, there's a lot of not eating meat. In part, there's just not a lot of space. The islands are small. There's not a lot of room for large animals. There's lots of chickens. And there were lots of pigs brought over by the Europeans. But there's not a lot of beef. And hence the milk. Therefore, there's not a lot of milk there. And then also, my family in particular grew up in the middle of the bush, very poor. And so they just didn't have access to meat. They didn't have access to those things. So I didn't grow up eating them much. My mom, you know, once she came to Canada, married my father, things were different, but she just relied on that sort of way that she had grown up eating. So I used to eat vegan food and not think of it as anything, and then realize, like, oh, that's a thing.
you were hip before it became hip to be vegan, right? I love the story about that you told about your dad cooking jellied pig's feet and your mom just having to leave because she couldn't handle it. Did you grow to like that more meat?
Yeah. I mean, I think that today I eat more meat sometimes than I think I should. So I do enjoy it, but I also appreciate that I feel completely satisfied without it. I think that for some people, I've had people ask me, but how do you have a meal without meat? To me, that's just such a foreign question because I've been doing it all my life.
Yes, when I first decided to become vegan or vegetarian, of course, my parents were appalled. Well, what does that mean? How am I going to feed you? What am I going to make for you, right? But it really, you don't, if you're not used to it, it makes total sense. So,
yeah.
Now, you write that life on an island might mean cooking with what you've got and getting creative. So how did that play out in the Caribbean dishes?
In general, like in So I think that there's a lot of ways in which people had to, like you said, get creative. I think the enslaved Africans, certainly they were there cooking without the things that they were used to at home. So they had to look to the indigenous people and nature to sort of make up for those things. And I think that's part of what made the cuisine different. Certainly, it's been noted that there's a lot of gluten-free recipes in the book, and that is in part because wheat wouldn't grow there. So they had to find other ways to make breads and things that were similar to breads without it. So that's why you get a lot of cornmeal things, and the cassava makes a good sort of substitute. I think my understanding is the Europeans were not very satisfied in the beginning, but I think they learned to like it.
Well, that's kind of like when we travel and we come into, we find different foods and different tastes and different flavors. And at first we're kind of like, ooh, what is this? And, you know, should I try it? And then once we've eaten it for a while, we can really appreciate a lot more than in the beginning, right?
Yeah, I agree. My daughter, I always say that one thing that makes her like a good eater, doesn't eat everything. She's certainly picky like anybody else's kid, but she will try anything. And I think it's because she's had enough positive experiences with unknown foods that she's willing to take the risk.
Well, good for her. I hope she keeps that up.
I hope so, too.
Now, you focus on 11 key ingredients that are important to Caribbean cuisine. Why don't you tell us what they are, and how did you narrow it down to just 11?
So the ingredients are beans, calabaza, which is a kind of squash, cassava, chayote, coconut, cornmeal, okra, plantains, rice, salted cod, and scotch bonnet peppers. And I came to this list through just kind of when I realized I wanted to write this book, advice was given to me to just cook and write. So as I was cooking and researching, I'm realizing these things keep coming up. Oh, yeah. Oh, they use cassava like that in Puerto Rico. Oh, Cuba has that okra dish. And so there were other ingredients that could have made the cut. But you know, I had to end it somewhere,
right?
red fruit almost made the list, but it didn't. So yeah, that's how it came to be. These are things that we all use. Scotch bonnets. I make a caveat in the book. Not everybody uses scotch bonnets. Most people use some kind of chili, and it is definitely a sign of the Caribbean.
Uh-huh, for sure. I mean, I think you wrote in that you pretty much put scotch bonnet in everything.
Yeah, before my daughter was born, everything, and now most things. Okay. I'm working on her heat tolerance.
How hot is a scotch bonnet? I don't think I've ever had one.
They are very hot.
Ah.
Yeah, they're probably, I think the ghost pepper is the hottest in the world, but the scotch bonnet is right up there. So the Scoville on the heat units, a scotch bonnet has 100 to 350,000 heat units, and for reference, jalapenos have 2,500 to 8,000.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's a little tangy.
Yeah, a little bit of a zip.
Before we continue, Leslie, where did the name come from, Bellyful?
That is a phrase that's often used in English-speaking Caribbean countries, they'll say, mi belly full. And it means both, obviously, your belly is full, you're full of food, but also, like, I'm content, I'm good, I have what I need.
That's great. That's a great phrase. I love it. Now, for those who might not be familiar with some of those Caribbean staples that we talked about earlier, can you find those in a regular grocery store?
So plenty of them you can, for sure. Of mm-hmm. course, beans and coconut milk, especially. A lot of the recipes don't have to be fresh coconut, which can be really difficult to work with, but I do love it. Okra, rice, and then plantains, I feel like, have found their way all over the place. I'm in the most random places and I'll see plantains. My dad lives in rural Ontario and they have plantains there.
Okay. So
I'm hoping that they're easy to find. Calabaza can be a little tricky. You really see it mostly in specifically Caribbean grocery stores, but it can be substituted with butternut or kabocha squash.
Okay.
And then the other ingredients, they can be found in Latin American stores because there's a lot of crossover there. Mm-hmm. And African grocery stores as well.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phones. We've got a couple of people wanting to give us a comment. Michael in Madison, you are first. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to toss in that little anecdote from me. Growing up in Madison, I kind of grew up with Miracle Whip as the tangiest thing that I would tolerate eating. And then as an adult, I had some coworkers from other countries tease me about that at work, and I said, that will not stand. And so I pushed myself, and in incorporating different spices, getting up to the level of being able to totally process and tolerate a Scotch bonnet, I want to tell people that it is doable and delicious. But I just wanted to point out that it has allowed me to push myself in language, push myself in understanding of the history of other countries, because all of that comes through food and through people talking about food. I know I don't have a meeting at work without some thought of food happening. So it's possible everybody can do it and you can all get there.
I love that, Michael. What a great way to open up your universe. What do you think, Leslie?
I love that, too. I think that's so true. Food is the connector. It's mm-hmm. the ultimate connector.
And it's almost like he was training for a marathon there, getting himself up to eat a Scotch bonnet.
I mean, Scotch bonnets are, yeah, that's like full-on marathon level.
For sure. Good for you. Let's go now to Suzanne. Suzanne in Madison. Go ahead, Suzanne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to mention that breadfruit would be a good addition for your next book, because I know a couple of Caribbean countries, like the island of Roatan, which belongs to Honduras. They have a big push there to grow the breadfruit tree again, so that there are multiple breadfruit trees, because they're really a major whole food, apparently, for the poorer people living on those islands. So I'd like to know more about breadfruit and recipes for that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Susan. Leslie, do you cook with breadfruit?
Yes, I do. And actually, because breadfruit was almost one of the featured ingredients of the book, it does have a little shout out in there, and there's some information about it. And it does come up in quite a few of the recipes because, as Suzanne said, it's a staple around the Caribbean. It was brought there from the South Pacific, I believe, where they called it the Tree of Life because it's so prolific and it fruits all year long, which is very interesting. So
yeah,
it was brought over here. The whole Mutiny on the Bounty happened because of breadfruit.
Really? And, I did
yes,
not know that.
There you go. That's where it all started. And in the beginning, no one wanted to eat it, but people eventually got used to it, and it's delicious. It's like a little bit sweet. It's really nice.
Okay, and what does it look like?
It's round and just green and has, I don't know how to explain, it has like a pattern all over it.
Okay.
It's not common, mm-hmm. unfortunately, to see here
mm-hmm.
fresh, but I have a feeling, I think, because there has been a big push, it's such a sustainable thing, I think that we will start to see it more.
Oh, that's great. Now, how do you use it? Do you cut it up? Is that...
Yeah, you cut it up. It's like a, it's kind of like a, it's not like a squash, but cooking with it is sort of like squash.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it tastes a little bit more like a potato. They call it breadfruit because it sort of tastes like bread. And you can boil it, you can roast it, you can grill it, you can fry it.
Wow. Very versatile.
Yeah, it is very versatile. Yeah. And like I said, it's delicious and nutritious.
Excellent. Sounds like a perfect food. Let's talk about some of those key ingredients individually now. Probably the most familiar to everybody is beans. What do you remember about growing up eating beans?
Just that we ate them all the time. I like have a love, not a hate relationship, but we ate beans all the time. And there were times where ask what's for dinner and black eyed peas. Oh, again. Okay. but I do love them. And I think that, again, I got so used to that being my protein that I'm really happy to have that today. And I think there's so many things you can do with beans. There's so many ways you can season them.
For sure.
And you can stew them, you can fry them, you can put them in lieu of, you can make burgers out of them. They're great.
Now, what kinds of beans are most commonly eaten in the Caribbean?
Quite a variety. So black beans and any kind of red bean, like a kidney bean, chickpeas, black-eyed peas,
mm-hmm.
Pigeon peas. That's a huge one. I grew up eating a lot of pigeon peas. I hated them when I was a kid. I could walk into like an aunt's house and smell and know, oh no. But now I love them. So I don't know. Thankfully, my daughter likes them.
I'm not familiar with a pigeon pea. What does that look like?
They're small and brown and round.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they also call them gungo peas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Let's.
Oh no.
You're done? We've covered peas. Okay, thanks. Now let's talk about the cassava. Now you write that it's representative of the Caribbean. What is it?
It's a root vegetable.
Okay.
It's like long, it's a long tuber. It's brown. It has a very hard skin on it. And here it's always a little bit shiny because they put wax on it, which apparently helps it to keep.
Ah, sure. I think we do that with some of apples and cucumbers,
sure,
things like that. Sure. Okay. Give us a little bit of a history of the cassava in the region.
So cassava is it's indigenous to the area. And people were making a cassava bread there for thousands of years before anybody else showed up, which they still make to this day. And apparently in Guyana specifically, they make it exactly as they've been making it. Since they've been making it.
Wow.
So there is perhaps nothing as Caribbean as cassava.
Okay. And what are some of your tips for preparing it?
So it can be a little bit difficult once you get the hang of it, it's pretty easy, but getting that skin off is not the easiest thing to do. I always say, do not use a vegetable peeler. You will be sad. You will be sorry. A little sharp paring knife, you make a slit and you sort of work the knife underneath and it will just come right off.
Okay, sure it will.
It genuinely does. But,
okay. Well, that's good to know, because if you know the key to peeling something, you're halfway there in any recipe.
Exactly. Exactly.
So there's a lot of different ways to use it, obviously. Do you have a favorite?
I think Bami is my favorite, which is you grate it and then fry it with coconut milk, which is just like all the good things. Coconut milk, fried. They're delicious.
Now, speaking of the coconut, it's pretty iconic on, pretty much any island, I guess.
And, yeah.
How did they get their name? You have that in the book.
Yeah. So apparently it's that the cocoa means like boogeyman.
Oh.
And I think because of, those round parts on it that look like a face, it looks,
yes.
And when you start to look at it, you'll never unsee it. It does look like a kind of a creepy face, really.
It really does. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think most of us who have thought about using a whole coconut have probably said, yeah, no, I don't know how to open it. So what are your tips for that?
So, yes, that's something I talk extensively about in the book because it's not easy. No. Breaking it is the key, and I find a lot of satisfaction in putting it inside a bag and going out my back door and just slamming it on the ground. But maybe that's not, you know, the more sort of professional way to do it is to tap it all around with a hammer or the heavy back of a knife, and it'll open up for you.
Really?
And then, yeah. And oh. I did not believe that because I grew up in a house of just throw it. but it does really work. And then once you've gotten it open, you can start to pry the pieces out.
Okay. Is it best to use like a knife or a spoon? Or, I mean, how do you take those pieces out?
I like to use like a dinner butter knife. I find that to be the easiest to work underneath it.
Okay.
If you find yourself a little clumsy, a small spoon might be better because there will be moments of slipping. And
yeah, because that's really important. That knife can be very dangerous for sure.
Yes.
So
yeah.
We are talking to Leslie Enston. She is an author, and her new book is called Belly Full, Exploring Caribbean Cuisine Through 11 Fundamental Ingredients and Over 100 Recipes. Okay, we're going back to our wonderful guest and Leslie, who's talking about Caribbean cooking. And we've got a question from someone who's actually listening to us, Cheryl in Iron Ridge. Hi, Cheryl. What's your question?
Well, you know, I want to ask her this. In 1992, probably before she was born, I had the wonderful opportunity to go to Tahiti. And when I visited Tahiti, I ate coconuts. And I can't tell you how wonderful they were. And when I came back from the trip, I bought a couple coconuts, took them home, and wound up literally throwing them away because they did not have the same flavor that the native people of Tahiti climbed the tree to get the coconut and then show us all of the layers of the coconut that can be used. It just didn't taste the same. So where does she get coconuts that taste like they came from the island?
Well, Leslie, what do you say about that one?
Well, in 1992, I was very much around. That is a good question. Nothing's ever going to be as good as it is when it's fresh picked. I definitely in Trinidad, I remember stopping somewhere and my uncle just getting some young boy, like, go climb up and get us a coconut. And he went and climbed up and got one and we cut it open and had it. And like, there's nothing as good as that. I'm fortunate enough to live somewhere that has a huge Caribbean diaspora. So I think that we get kind of fresher more often. They're coming here more often, ingredients. So that's something that's lucky for me. I think that's one of the reasons why I focused a lot on coconut milk, like canned coconut milk, because not everyone has access to coconuts just generally and not fresh coconuts. Unfortunately, I think you're going to have to go back to Tahiti to get that.
Gee, that's hard. I'll go with you, Cheryl. I'll be happy to go with you and help you carry those coconuts back. How do you pick out a good coconut if you do decide to buy one in the store? What's to look for?
That can be really tricky because I have tried all the things that I know and come home with a rotten coconut on more than one occasion. One thing you do want for sure is it should be heavy and sloshing around with a lot of liquid. There should be all that good coconut water in there. If you don't hear it, it's old and it's dried up and you don't want that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And some places will cut them open for you if you want to make sure that it's good.
Oh, that's a good option. I didn't think about that. Although I don't know if I've ever seen anybody doing that. Pineapple, yes. Coconut, no. So they probably don't know how to open them, Leslie.
I can give them a tutorial.
There you go. I'll bring your book along. There you go. Now, we're talking about Scotch bonnet peppers earlier. So what do you recommend for someone who's never tried this type of pepper before? I mean, how do you know how much to use?
go slow. So definitely all the heat or most of the heat is in the seeds. So when you're using it, scoop those out and you can just discard them. And then I, for instance, when I'm cooking for my daughter, I'll just use a tiny sliver of Scotch bonnet and chop that up and put it in the dish. And then you can see how that works out for you.
Okay.
And, you know, and go from there. But yeah. Start small.
Start really small. Or you can substitute a different pepper, can't you? That's a little, maybe a jalapeno or something that's a little bit not quite
you
so
could.
Spicy.
The thing about Scotch bonnets is they have a really particular taste in addition to the heat. They have this like beautiful smoky taste.
Okay.
So you can certainly, if you can't get your hands on them. And I have seen dried Scotch bonnet pepper. So that's an option too, if you can find that online.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing is quite like a Scotch bonnet.
Well, I think I'm going to have to try a little teeny tiny piece of it just to get that flavor from you. One of the things on your list I thought was interesting was the salted cod. Okay, we're talking about being surrounded by water here. Why salt it? Because that's a storage thing, right?
Absolutely. So it started off as being a way to sustain people on this boat ride going back and forth between Africa and the islands and Europe and the islands. So they needed something that wouldn't go bad. You know, they were on the sea for a long time. They wanted something that was cheap. It was very cheap at the time. The seas were prolific with them, and they lived up north. So the English had the lock on the salted cod, and it's just become part of the cuisine. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people think about fresh fish in the Caribbean,
right,
which of course
yeah.
there is fresh fish. And I've had, I mean, some of the best fish I've ever had has been just caught there. But day to day in most homes, salted cod is the fish that you're seeing being eaten.
Yeah, I thought that was quite unusual. How is it stored?
You can store it straight out on the counter if you want, because there's so much salt in it, which you take out, of course, before you eat it. I prefer to store it in the fridge only because fruit flies like it, and that's gross.
Mm-hmm.
But it can keep kind of indefinitely.
Okay. And is that pretty readily available in grocery stores?
I think it's pretty prolific. There's a lot of different people in the world that use salted cod, including in Europe. So you can, sometimes they call it bacalao.
Okay. Now, one other thing on your list is plantains, and I think we've become a lot more used to seeing those in grocery stores. What are some of your favorite ways to use plantains?
Oh, I just love every way to use plantains. I think my number one favorite thing is just fried green ones. I did not grow up with that. I didn't even know it was an option growing up, which was very upsetting when I found out. Like, why was my mom holding out on me? But I say I'm a person, I love French fries. It's one of my weaknesses, but I would say goodbye to ever to French fries if it just meant keeping fried green plantains.
Wow. I have never tasted any. So what does it kind of taste like?
Ooh, well, fried starchy goodness. It's a little bit like a potato, but it has a bit more of a robust flavor.
Mm-hmm.
The green ones are not sweet at all. They're very starchy. I don't know. Yeah. And they're such a good vessel for like pickled things or mm-hmm. spicy things.
They look like bananas, right? Little tiny. Is that a plantain?
Bigger. They're bigger.
Bigger.
But they
okay.
do look like bananas. They yeah, they're like bananas.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But do they taste like bananas?
When they're ripe, they taste quite similar. Not
okay.
the same. They're heartier,
mm-hmm.
both in texture and flavor, but it's similar. It's not, it wouldn't be a stretch.
Okay. So if you had to introduce someone to Caribbean food who had never eaten any of it before, what would that menu look like?
Oh my gosh, that's a really difficult question. Well, let's do some fried plantains.
Okay.
Because obviously. And salted cod, some sort of a salted cod dish, probably something stewed. Like I grew up eating buljol, which is the Trinidadian version. Everybody makes a version of that. So I think that's really like very Caribbean. And rice and beans.
Okay. What about sweet stuff? Do you have any desserty kind of food?
Oh yeah. There's something called an arepa, which is from the Dominican Republic, made out of cornmeal. It's like sweet cornbread. It's really delicious.
Mm-hmm.
There's several coconut recipes, of course, because coconut and sugar goes so well together.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, and sugar goes well with a lot of things. Okay. Well, I really want to appreciate or thank you. We appreciate you spending some of your time with us, Leslie. And I think you probably need to write another book because obviously you left out some ingredients. So.
I'll work on it right now.
Okay. Well, then we want you back. Thank you so much. You're welcome. We've been talking with Leslie Enston. She is an author and home cook, and her book is called Belly Full, Exploring Caribbean Cuisine Through 11 Fundamental Ingredients and Over 100 Recipes. And if you don't want to write that down or can't remember it, we do have a link on our website. So just go to WPR.org/Larry, go to today's date, and you will see that on there. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Madell.